one and all, once again, to Dual Wielding. This week, we presented a very special episode. Like we mentioned last week, we're going to be dividing up the next few episodes over the next 3 or 4 weeks to get through Christmas and New Year's without having to harass people during the holidays. This week, we're going to look at the top 10 games of this generation. Before we get there, I want to introduce our panel. We have Jason joining us.
Hello.
We have Adrian.
What's up, guys?
Who may or may not be in the background cursing at Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom. Most of this. And we have Chad, who's feeling pressure because he has to actually do something this show.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer. I don't like this at all.
As we said last week, the rules of this are we're going to do the top 10 games from 2005 to 2010. I think there's a 2011 game that snuck onto my list. I'm not going to fight it. It has to be games that were originally released this generation. So stuff like Resident Evil 4, Beyond Good and Evil, Persona 4, Ocarina of Time don't count, even though they were released on consoles. I guess Ocarina of Time wouldn't have counted because the 3DS is technically next gen.
God damn it. It'd be perfect if it could. That'd be like the game of the year for me.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons you don't want to cheat these games that were kind of
game of 1994.
Yeah, because I know when I was sitting there looking at the list of best games this generation, I was thinking, "Fuck, I really wish I could put a 15-year-old game on this list."
And you know, that's kind of the thing. I mean, there are games. I think Ocarina of Time, I mean, my personal opinions aside, is one of those games that's kind of held up as one of the greatest games of all time. And stuff like that in Resident Evil 4, which have this huge reputation, which is kind of overshadowed games. But we want to talk about games that kind of shine bright this generation, that were new to this gen. We're not counting handhelds, really, just because I don't want to deal with a headache. I think three systems on PC or Mac are enough. I don't know if anybody's actually even included a mobile game. I'm sure Angry Birds would have been number one on everybody's list. But,
God, if anybody fucking picked Angry Birds, I would leave this forever. Like, I would never do this again.
Can I have a couple minutes to rework my list?
I have Angry Birds Rio, I have Angry Birds...
But it's Angry Birds Seasons?
Well, I didn't think it was a coincidence that you said six games, and there's six different Angry Birds games. I mean, it made sense at the time.
Wait, are there really six different Angry Birds?
I have no idea. I made that shit up.
Okay. I know about Angry Birds, I know about Rio, and I know about Seasons or Holidays or whatever it is.
That's pretty much
it. Yeah, but then there's Angry Birds for Chrome, Angry Birds for PSP Mini,
Jesus,
Angry Birds for iPad.
There's Angry Birds Magic, apparently, too.
There's Angry Birds, the board game.
Angry Birds, the movie.
You know what? There's an Angry Birds animated series coming out at some point. But this is not the Angry Birds dedication podcast.
It's insane. The game's not even that good. I don't get it.
It's not even that original. It's like another idea with birds. I don't even know what the birds do that makes it such a popular game with people.
It just hits the right beats with most people for mobile games, you know?
I think
small bite-sized chunks and...
I think Fruit Ninja and Cut the Ropes are better games.
Tiny
I think
Wings.
The Rope is way better.
Oh, Tiny Wings is the sickest game ever.
But yeah. We're not talking about mobile games this episode.
None of these games are on our list.
No, I'd not be opposed to having a mobile game podcast. I think there's enough of them now where I think they're a legitimate thing. But we are talking about our top 10 games of this generation, and the way we're doing this is everybody's coming to the table with about six games. Some are over, some are under. The idea is that roughly by the time we're done, it's going to be about 20 to 30 games, and then we're going to narrow that list down to 10. And from that 10, we're going to organize them into a top 10, 1 through 10 list. As you would notice, Daniel and Anthony haven't joined us this week. I don't know what happened to Anthony. We're even recording this an hour behind schedule because of some technical difficulties. So he's had more than enough time to show up or send a message. I don't know.
So we're putting him on blast right here.
Daniel,
where's your DK rap, Anthony?
Daniel, on the other hand, did contact me this morning. Something came up and he won't be able to make it. But he was kind enough to forward his list. And I guess we'll start there since he's not actually...
Doesn't excuse the fact that he's not here.
Whatever, that's one less person I have to try to make a case for Catherine to, so, fine with this.
Oh, great. All right, let's do it. Let's get right to it.
Yeah, so get into Daniel's List now. Daniel's List, and these aren't in order because the whole point is that we're going to put them in order later on.
And keep in mind that he cannot defend himself.
I mean, he can't defend himself or his games, but he has a very decent list. Halo 3, Portal, Uncharted 2, Red Dead Redemption, Mass Effect 2, and Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare.
Wow, Portal over Portal 2, I'm a little surprised.
I think, again, it kind of goes back, and this is an issue we're going to run into, I'm assuming, where a lot of times, you know, sequels tend to be better than the original. That's the point of a sequel. But a lot of people give credit to the first game because, you know, it was the original. And it's sometimes hard to kind of have that this is amazing thing going on again. I think I was more surprised about Halo 3 over Reach.
Yeah. I was surprised about that, too. We were talking in the pre-show.
Yeah. I've said it before. I think Reach and ODST have the best campaigns in the franchise. I guess it probably was a multiplayer thing. I know a lot of people aren't too keen on the Reach's multiplayer because of armor ability and stuff like that. So maybe it was that we preferred Halo 3's more balanced multiplayer approach. The rest of the list is pretty solid. I mean, two of them were contenders for Game of the Day last year, right? The Redemption of Mass Effect 2. And, you know, Call of Duty's...
One of them was our quote-unquote co-Game of the Year.
Yes, one of them was...
Even though retroactively it had more votes.
It's not my fault. Somebody changed their mind after we recorded the podcast. I guess technically Adrian could have broken the tie at some point, but...
Yeah, because he would have said StarCraft.
That was in the code.
That was in the code last year.
I don't even like StarCraft anymore anyway. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's not something you want to say.
I'm sorry.
My one ally is now gone.
Wait till Heart of the Swarm comes out, and then we'll see what you say.
That's a good plan. That's actually probably a good... Well, I mean, okay, real quick, before we... I'm not going to derail
StarCraft
this conversation.
StarCraft Minute, it's happening.
StarCraft Minute, 60 seconds. All right. I can't get... I don't know, like, StarCraft is one of those games that if you don't play it almost exclusively for, like, months or at a time, you will just be bad. Like, every time I go back and play it, I'm like, God, I am so bad at this game. Like, it's one of those things where I don't even know why I'm losing because I'm so bad. Like, I made it to Gold League, and then that was it. I just kept losing forever. I was like, okay. So, I don't know. I can't get into a game if it requires all my attention every time.
I assume you don't do MMOs either, then?
Nope.
Nope. I'm really curious about the Old Republic, but I don't think I'm going to have the commitment to it.
And I think we talked about this before, and I hate to go on tangents, but I really do think that if you're going to have an MMO, you really need to cut the entry price if you're going to charge a monthly fee. Because it's really hard to justify paying 50, 60 bucks and then having to pay 10 or 15 bucks on top of that every month to pay. But that's neither here nor there. Who wants to go first? Okay, Chad, you're up.
Oh, great.
Catherine.
Awesome.
Catherine. Catherine.
Oh, wait. Well, before Chad gets started, the other reason I actually didn't want to include 2011 games, and this is a really kind of backwards logic, is that I didn't want to tip our hands towards our Game of the Year podcast.
I kind of left one off my list partially for that reason. Because it's a surprise.
Yeah, because yeah, if everyone, it's probably The Witcher 2. But
damn it! Okay, well, let's say that I have a 2011 game on my list.
It's not what
could I take that and replace it with, like, say, Persona 4?
This is not a negotiation. The rules can't be bent just because you can have a 2011 game if you want. There's nothing against it. I'm just saying that I didn't want to do it because it also tips the hands towards our Game of the Year podcast. But go on.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Where's my list? List. There it is. Great. I wrote the shit on paper, man. This is a list-ass list.
Yeah, I was about to say, I have a copy of all your lists, and you still can't... Everybody sent them before the show started, so we know what's on it. And you couldn't find it?
Papers, man. I'm a busy guy.
I have everybody's written down on paper, too.
I've got, like, physics on my desk and stuff. I can't have time for lists. Okay, here we are. Yeah. Gonna preface this by saying... these are the top six games that I feel were, like, the most impactful or the biggest or, like, high quality, not necessarily in any way my favorite games at all, and some of these I don't even really like.
Then why would you put it on your list?
Because they're really good. Like, Call of Duty 4. I'm way done with Call of Duty. Call of Duty is... I've had my fill. But you can't deny that Call of Duty 4 completely changed the genre of FPS. Like, perks, leveling, that's what started all of it.
Yeah,
Call of Duty is a huge... Call of Duty 4 is a huge game. So it's like, it deserves to be on my list, even though I'm so over Call of Duty.
And I get that to a degree, but like I said before when we were doing the pre-show, is that this isn't technically a most influential game for this generation. I think, you know, like it has to be a divide between, you know, I can understand that you would associate being the best game with being the one that's probably the most, you know, genre-defining of the generation. But it doesn't necessarily... I mean, you could say...
And even then, it was still a really good game.
It's a fantastic game.
It's the only game I've ever bought on both PS3 and 360 just to play multiplayer on both consoles. Like,
really?
It was huge at the time, yeah.
I've already done that with one game, and I'm just adding that to my list now. Okay, so Call of Duty 4.
What else? Gears of War. Although, like, Gears of War 2, it was really close for me, because Gears of War did it first, but Gears 2 did it better, and apparently Gears 3 does it even better, but fuck that game.
What?
Yes.
He's still sick, because he can't play it.
No, he's bitter, because his Xbox broke, so he can't play it.
While I was playing the Gears 3 beta, no less.
But I thought it broke while you were downloading the Gears 3 beta.
No, I downloaded it, installed it, ran it, and then it went, like, nuts. Anyway, so yeah, Gears of War, Gears of War 2, Gears of War 3, whatever, it's a series.
I think you're naming all three.
Whatever.
Let's just say
three, because it's a whole head above the rest.
Okay. So yeah, just because, again, that was kind of revolutionary as well, and it was a damn good game. The Gears of War series have been kind of my favorite shooters of this generation, I think.
I think 3 is my favorite shooter this year.
Yeah, I mean, I have played like 3 different shooters in the last generation, so
it narrows the field down a bit. But
yeah, but out of those, Gears of War was definitely the best, so that's on my list. So yeah, Call of Duty and Gears. Sequels abound, again, Metal Gear Solid 4, because... Man, that game is so good. So good. A perfect end to that saga. Just.
What do you mean end?
That franchise is never gonna
end. There's already been another one, and there's another one, two more coming.
Yeah, but that storyline is over. Like,
we'll see.
Yeah.
No. They are locked in.
I was promised that Halo 3 was to finish the fight, and they've spent 2 games since then, and they're doing a brand new trilogy, so...
But those are in different storylines. Like, Reach is a different, separate thing. It's a Halo game, but it's not a continuation of...
It's a prequel, but how do you explain through 6?
Yeah, I don't know. Man, whatever, fuck Halo. I've got 2 balls for Halo to put in its mouth, is all I have to say about that. So Metal Gear Solid 4, a fantastic game. Changed the gameplay from the previous Metal Gear Solid games while still keeping the essence of it. Like, it focused a whole lot more on first person. The shooting was actually not shit, which is amazing for a Metal Gear game. First time that's ever happened. It's like it made all these improvements to all the things it needed to improve while still keeping the gameplay, like, tropes that the series has embodied, and also just staying as batshit crazy as humanly possible, which you have to love.
I forgot about that game, to be honest.
Which one?
MGS4, yeah.
Really?
In thinking of this list, I don't know. It came out so long ago. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't count. It definitely is worthy.
No, we're not going to...
It just was out of my mind.
No, that's one I hadn't thought of until I went back to look at a release calendar to just refresh what had come out, and I was like, oh, fuck, that happened.
And like I said, this is kind of why I didn't want to do 2011 games on it, because you tend to think of the games you recently played that were awesome, and not the whole 5-year spectrum. But yeah, what else you have?
Yeah, but nothing that came out this year beats last year. So,
we'll discuss that on the podcast in a couple of weeks. I kind of agree with you, though.
Not to say this year's games are bad at all, this is a great year for games, but as far as top of the line.
I was going to say this is a good year for games, but I don't think there was anything. I think in the grand scheme of things, you won't see anything that's really world-defining. Like, I think Skyrim, Skyward Sword, and
I think Noir
will have an impact going forward.
Yeah, I was going to say L.A. Noir is one of the most important games of this generation.
I don't necessarily think those, oh my gosh, these are amazing games. It's just like it's been a very steady stream of great games, but nothing.
Yeah.
Out there, but that's for another day. Chad has two more, I believe.
Three more, actually. I'm really slow. the best game to have come out on the PlayStation 3 thus far, and maybe... No, not this generation, never mind. Actually, no, maybe not even the PS3. Anyway, it's really, really good. Notice how I'm committing to everything that I say here and not going back on it at all. Uncharted 2 was a damn fine game, better than the third in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah, and
I enjoyed it more than the third, and it's gorgeous. The storytelling is amazing. The characterization is godly. The shooting is acceptable. I feel like I'm looking back on it more fondly than I probably should. I haven't played it in a while. But
I just played it over the summer, and yeah, it still holds up.
I think that's important, the fact that you can look back at it 2 years and you have those fond memories because you want that time to settle in, because there are games you played, and then you look back and you don't remember what the hell you played or why you enjoyed it so much. Two more to go.
Right. Okay, so this is my 2011 game slot, in which I really wanted to put one, but I'm way too lazy and tired and hungover, so I'm not going to take the 12 days it would take to argue in favor of Catherine, because let's face
it. What? No Catherine on the list?
No one's going to let that... It's on my list, but you motherfuckers aren't going to let that fly, and I know it.
Hey, so you know I have praise for Catherine.
That's true.
Are you gonna have?
I wouldn't put it top six, but I have praise for Catherine.
Would you have put it? Yeah, you're not gonna put it top six. I don't think anybody's gonna argue for being top 10 game of the generation, honestly.
Which is why I'm not bothered.
Yeah.
On my list, it's fucking right up there. Anyway, Skyrim instead gets that spot. So just because Skyrim is in here as my 2011 game doesn't necessarily mean it's my 2011 game of the year. I just don't want to blow all my filibustering. So Skyrim, I mean, it's basically working on the formula that Oblivion did, except way less bugged, while still managing to remain pretty bugged.
You're not paying the PS3.
That's a Bethesda game.
Yeah, exactly. And it does this formula better than I think anything's done it this generation, which is obviously makes it worthy to be top six, in my opinion. And then, of course, the last game. You've all been expecting it. You know it's coming. The game of the eternity, StarCraft II.
I mean, I always hope for Angry Birds.
Because that game is just infinitely replayable, constantly evolving. It's a game that never gets old because the people who play it are constantly doing new things. You can never finish it. It is never over, and that's ridiculous and awesome and amazing, and I love it.
Okay, just to recap, Uncharted 2, Skyrim, StarCraft 2, Metal Gear Solid 4, Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare, and Gears of War.
Solid bliss.
Okay,
so.
Jason, you're up.
Alright, I guess we'll start with Alan Wake is my one of my top six. It's just so different from anything else. Like, and it's, apart from the nutcracker jaws that all the characters have, it's just perfect. Like, the story is, like, has these twists and keeps you going. You know, it's, like, kind of a scary game. It keeps you on edge all the time, but it never, like, you always have enough ammo, and I don't know, man, it's just really good. Everything about that game, like the ambiance, the setting, the characters, the writing, there's just nothing else like it. And, no comments?
I haven't played Alan Wake, I can't say anything.
Ah. Alright,
well, gonna pick it up from my 360, which is busted, so fuck that.
Ooh, that's too bad. I'm pretty stoked for Night Springs, but I digress. So I guess just moving on, since everyone's so quiet. Assassin's Creed 2.
Why did you
all
pick
right,
this?
Assassin's Creed.
Because it's the best one in the
okay.
series.
I was curious. I've heard good things about Brotherhood.
Brotherhood is also very good. I give 2 the edge because, first of all, I ignore multiplayer. Even though the multiplayer is fantastic, has nothing to do with my Games of the Generation consideration. But 2, I think, had a better story, a more focused story. Like, Brotherhood, yeah, it's very good, but you can tell they were starting to be like, oh, let's squeeze out what we can from this before we move on. Revelations, even more so. And while they tweaked a bunch of stuff, 2, I think, really set the stage for everything that happened. And the way they, you know, take events throughout history and like tie it into the fiction of the game, like, it, this is one of the better stories that is in video games, I think.
Okay.
Yeah,
I can get that. Yeah, plus the going from 1 to 2, like, it's just so, they just blew the lid off. Like, that's how you make a sequel for a good idea that wasn't fleshed out all the way. But anyways, my next one is going to be Arkham Asylum. Also better than its sequels, I think.
Sequel.
Technically, there's an iOS sequel now.
What is that? But I don't have an iOS device, so I didn't care.
I don't know. I haven't tried it. I heard it was, like, Infinity Blade-ish.
Huh.
I probably should try that. I don't know. Anyway, Arkham Asylum. It was my game of the year that year. What was that, 2008, I think?
2009.
Or 9?
Yeah.
And it's just, one thing it does better than any other game, I think, is taking great parts of other games and incorporating it into its own design. Like, for example, you know, the BioShock tapes that you find around the world that you just, they play while you're still exploring. It doesn't stop gameplay. It borrowed from Assassin's Creed and refined it even way better than Assassin's Creed did. The combat system that's rhythm-based and counter-based. I mean, just so much stuff. And beyond everything else, I think is a textbook example of how to do a licensed video game, not let's try to stretch a 2-hour movie or hour-and-a-half movie into a 9-hour experience. Let's take this property and take what's good about it for this medium. And I think what really puts it beyond City is the pacing and the settings that are just, I mean, there's none better.
Yeah, I will agree. I mean, just to tip my hand, that's also my list. And I guess just to jump in here, it's a fantastic game. And a part of it is the fact that it does really make you feel like the character of Batman, which I think is important in a licensed game, that you get the feel
yeah.
of the character. Because if this was just a generic action game, I don't think it would have been as impressive, as you said. But the, you know, just immersing you in Gotham with Batman, these characters, and the voice work and the acting, just, you know.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Phenomenal work. I mean, these are people who've been playing the characters for 20-some-odd years. Fantastic game. It's up there with, it's on the list, and we'll get to that in a bit. You have, go on.
Alright, so I'm halfway, I believe? Yeah, okay. So next I have BioShock,
yeah.
which, yeah, definitely I think will consider warrant a lot of consideration. It was just one of the first games to really cement the medium as being, like, capable of, like, intelligent artistic expression. And, I mean, not even just, you know, the environments are amazing. The story has these twists that are entertaining, the gameplay is fantastic, but you know, the fact that it can be a game that has a philosophical commentary on the way games are designed, I mean nothing else does that. There's just simply nothing else that's even tried. Even BioShock 2, just that's what was missing from BioShock 2 for me, was that next, like, kind of above the game kind of thing where you can sit back on it after and be like, what did this mean?
Can you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by like a commentary on how games are made?
Well, I guess it's been out enough for long enough, so we shouldn't worry about spoilers. But
I think 4 years is a period
yeah.
of time.
I mean, basically, the fact that it directly, with the twist of the would you kindly thing in the story, right?
Oh, okay, I see where you're going with this.
It directly addresses the issue of, you know, the character that you're playing. This whole time up to that point, think there's an illusion that he's making all his choices, whereas within the story, that character is actually not making any choices. He's being told what to do. And that's the exact same thing that is part of the game. As a player, you have the illusion that you're making the choice to do everything that you want to do, but really you're doing what the designers want you to do. And it's sort of this, I think where it kind of falls apart a little bit is after that point, you're still in that, even though technically you shouldn't be. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's like this commentary on the illusion of choice.
I think it's really interesting that you say that, because like, now that you bring that into perspective, the idea that basically, you know, it also plays on the typical trope of like the omnipotent, like, narrator in a way. I mean, he doesn't Atlas, you know, or Frank Fontaine, however you want to call him, but he doesn't actually, you know, behave as the narrator. But the fact that, you know, in most video games, you just kind of blindly follow the guide, and yeah. the game and the narrative itself really prey on that fact, and they just, it makes you feel like played. Like, it makes you feel been played. But the second that it's like, would you kindly, and you're just like, what the fuck?
I would say probably the single most mind-blowing moment.
That game has legitimately ruined every single set piece for me in every game ever. Nothing has ever, in my history of gaming, since I played BioShock 1, impacted me in that same way as going, wait, what? And then the way that they revealed all that information, like, you know, they just, would you kindly, and it's, would you kindly grab, you know, go kill that son of a bitch. And it's just like, you think about it, and it amazes me that they were able to pull that off with such, you know, it's not like, it wasn't obvious, you know what I mean? Like, you just kind of go, oh, it's a part of his cute little Irish accent or whatever. And then, you know, boom. Would you kindly? And it's amazing that you don't think.
No, it was so well done. It was like playing BioShock the first time is such a good experience. Like, that's what games should be. And like, in an age where we're just all like, how many more explosions can we have? How many more guns can we have? You know, how much more multiplayer can we have? Like, that game, it nailed everything it tried to do from a game design perspective, like gameplay perspective, and just went and try to do things that no other game before or since has tried to do, including its own sequel, and until BioShock Infinite, I'm assuming. And that's,
you know,
really use the medium to, you know, do more than just entertain.
I honestly have no idea how they are going to top BioShock with Infinite. Like, I mean, the one thing that, okay, just, well, I want to talk about BioShock, because this game is literally probably the best game of this generation, if I really think about it. I think it might just be the best game. But the voice acting in BioShock, I think, is so... the thing that I like about it is, you know, with Call of Duty, you have, like, all these celebrity voices that you can pretty easily identify. You know, they're pretty out there. They're pretty easily spotted, basically. But with BioShock, they always find these guys that are, you know, kind of well-known in their own little respective circles, but... I mean, if you listen to the comment or the narrative or the god the com- ah, voice acting in BioShock and in, you know, the upcoming Infinite, it has this gravity and this weight that other voice acting just doesn't have. Like, it doesn't feel like a video game. It feels more like something. It feels like interactive media, and I'm sorry, you got me started. Look what you've done.
No, I mean, we could talk about this all day, but yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is it's
that good.
It's so much more than just a piece of entertainment, which is not, so far, not a lot of games can say that. But anyway.
I don't think any other game can say that.
Yeah, I mean, you could definitely, like, well.
I don't see how that's a bad thing, though.
What?
That other games haven't, like, lived
it's
up
not,
to that?
It's not good or bad, it's just a way to measure how the medium's maturing from, like, an artistic perspective, narrative perspective, yes. So, before we get too into Bioshock, because everyone's lost to go, my next one is Uncharted 2, which Chad already mentioned all the good reasons for. I think the only thing I want to add is that it's the only, not the only game, but it's the best example of taking lessons from Hollywood in terms of presentation. Things like cinematography, dialogue, right? Like, all those things, and putting them in a game. And I hate the argument people use that games and film are different media, and they should ignore each other, because that's just so short-sighted. Yeah, they're fundamentally different, but there's a lot of crossover, and it's so... It drives me nuts when developers just ignore all the progress that's been made for the 100 years that film has been around when it comes to, you know, if you have a... It obviously, it doesn't apply to every game, but for a game like Uncharted, where you're basing yourself around scripted events and, like, cinematic storytelling, you have to use those techniques, and it does it better than any other game.
I think, and this is kind of the fault we're seeing with Uncharted 3, not to deviate too much from that, is that at some point, though, you do kind of force to play his hands if you're just guiding them along a path, and not so much, it's not like they're going on a journey, it's like them watching an interactive movie at that point. And I feel like there's a pushback against that this gen, as we've seen with Uncharted 3 and other games, where being a linear game is kind of seen as a negative thing now.
Right, but I'm like going beyond just the fact, just that it's linear design. I mean, even going down to the level of a cutscene, a simple cutscene, something that many games have, whether they're linear or not. Like, I'll give you an example, Skyrim, or any Bethesda game, right? When you get in a conversation, people just stand around, you know, the camera doesn't move, they talk with no emotion, blah, 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 blah. Uncharted 2, better than any other game, you know, uses camera angles, uses cuts, you know, things that emphasize what people are saying, emphasize the drama, emphasize the points that are going on, and that's why it's, like, so much more involving than a narrative like Skyrim.
And I get your point with that, but in order for Uncharted to do that, they have to control so much of the game, because you framed, and there's no, like, two ways to frame a scene. With Skyrim, you could come to somebody in multiple different ways, and there's not a way to program it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, just use a Mass Effect, for example, I'm sure that's on the list. That's a game where you kind of have, you know, like, your reputation is something that translates into scenes and interactions with characters, and then to just have to program it two or three different ways for a scene to play out would be more time-consuming than making sure it's the best possible game you can make. And I'm sure there's going to come a point, and we mentioned earlier in the war, which I don't think is going to make anybody exist, but I think, you know, that's a game where a lot of time was spent on the tech. The game side of it wasn't that great.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
So, you're going to come to a point where, like, if you want to go like Hollywood and you want to have this really narrative-driven script, you're going to have to be so narrowly focused to control everything that you're going to take away that player control, like you mentioned before.
But I'm not, I mean, I'm not saying even from, like, the overall design of the game, which is a different argument, because Uncharted is one way and Skyrim is a different way, and they do their own methods really well. I'm talking, like, specifically about, you know, very specific situations, like conversations, for example.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that the reason is that there's no two ways to go about anything in Uncharted. So that Naughty Dog has the ability to frame everything how they want, because it's always going to play out that one way, no matter how you approach it. And it's...
Let's go to Mass Effect now. Because it's kind of in between these two games, where you do have a kind of a quasi-open-world structure, and you do have ways that the narrative can branch into different directions, but they still use cinematic techniques when you're in conversations and stuff.
Yeah, but sometimes you still have characters who just stand around staring awkwardly at you while they wait for you to make a response.
But less so than in 2. Like, in 2, they actually move around, the camera changes angles, you know, it uses different techniques like the rule of thirds and, you know, the 180 degree axis and, like, just all, you know, just basic things that enhance little parts of the story.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm just saying that I think, like, I'm sure GTA does the same thing where it kind of has some type of cinematic series. The commercials always play that up. But I'm just saying that it's really going to be hard to kind of balance it where a gaming wants to be pushed forward towards more open world, more player-driven stuff, and then trying to have, like, this really cinematic experience. Because you don't think, one of the things you end up doing is you end up using the flow and the pacing of a game in an open world. Because, like, Skyrim, for example, you have people who deviate from the main plot for 20, 30 hours at a time.
Oh, well, you know what? To be fair, like, I was playing Skyrim earlier, and there's one thing that I've noticed about Skyrim. The game doesn't give you any direction, like, at all. That's part of the beauty of the game, is that it doesn't require this level of, you know, dedication that so many other games seem to be obsessed with, but sometimes I really appreciate having that clear-cut objective, because it's kind of the reason why games like Red Dead Redemption and Grand Theft Auto lose my interest so quickly, is because I'll be playing them and I'm like, okay, well, there's this narrative, but they're not really, like, I kind of like having somebody nudging me gently to kind of say, okay, this is where we really want you to see this, but we're going to just kind of, like, let you know subtly. But with Skyrim, it's literally, you get out of the main, you know, first intro thing, which, by the way, was pretty bad, in my opinion. I don't really think that the intro of any of the Elder Scrolls games are good. I think that, especially in Skyrim's case, the animations are really stilted and awkward.
It's because it emphasizes the shortcomings of Skyrim. Because Skyrim's at its best when it's just wide open, right?
Or
And when you're in the beginning and it's hyper-focused, like an Uncharted, you know, it's clearly not designed to be that type of experience.
And it clearly shows that the developers are just like, okay, like, why are we doing this?
It's two different, and I think increasingly different schools of game design, where you have, you know, wide open choice, blah, 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 and you have the other side is we have a super focused narrative. We are building things that are going to happen, and they're always going to happen. And it's more about you. It's not about you putting your footprint on the experience. It's about you going along for the ride.
And I think
those are two completely different ways to make games.
Yeah, and the problem, and I think the best school, and we're really off topic right now, is the middle ground. And like you mentioned, Mass Effect does a great job of this, where Mass Effect is kind of, it's a narrative-driven game, but it's like, you know what, oh, there's like, here's like 6 missions, go tackle them in whichever order you want, but they're all progressing the plot forward. I mean, well, technically, I've had issues with this with Mass Effect 2, and we mentioned this actually for the Game of the Year podcast, is that it's actually more character-driven than plot-driven, but that's besides the point. I think that you mentioned this with BioShock, I think given the paid idea that they're in control is more important than anything.
Right.
You can have a linear experience, but make the player believe that they're the ones in control and us. It's not just the game pushing them forward.
Well, and you brought up the perfect segue to my last candidate, which is Mass Effect 2. Shock and awe, I know. But, I mean, it's just, I mean, I've talked about it so many times. It's just the complete package. It does everything. It has the choice. It has the strong linear storytelling. It has the great gameplay. It has the strong characters and everything, and more than anything else, it, like, choice matters more than in any other game, and between games, which is something that
not a lot of games do.
No other games do, really. Like, what, there was a couple things from Fable and The Witcher, but as far as taking an entire narrative over the course of 3 games and having your choices actually change, you know, what happens in that narrative, I mean,
I assume the reason that a lot of people don't do it, and we'll see what Mass Effect 3 is, that if you have fans with the first one, it's kind of a built-in audience, which is awesome, but then it becomes harder and harder for people to jump in at 2 or 3 if they haven't played the first one.
Right, I mean, and that's definitely going to be a challenge, especially when you know, the gameplay is so different as in between 1 and 2, where once I'm in 2, it's hard to go back to 1, you know, and that's where it's kind of different than, like, you know, a set of movies. If the sequel comes out, it's nothing to go back and watch the first one first. In a game, you know, you have to invest 20 hours into the first one before you get into the second one. But that being said, you know, it was ballsy of BioWare to do it anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, you won't get the complete experience of Mass Effect 2 if you didn't play 1, just flat out. Just because if you jumped in a 2, you're detached from what happened in 1.
Yeah.
Because then it's just backstory instead of, I did this. This is in the world because of me.
I was going to say, because I've heard, I haven't checked it out, the digital comic that came with Mass Effect 2 when it was ported to the PS3. A lot of people were saying that it kind of gets the gist of it, but it does kind of miss some of the more personal.
Right. I mean, it was the best they could do with that situation. And I mean, doing that comic is better than not playing the first game or having anything to do with the first game at all. Because at least you have your input on the big, major situations. But you lose a lot of the smaller stuff, and you lose, you know, like, distilling a 20-hour story into, like, a 5-minute comic, obviously, you're going to lose a lot.
I would have rather had the digital comic than started from just the start of Mass Effect 2, which is what I did. Because they're talking about all sorts of stuff, and I'm like, oh, I don't know what this is. I don't know what happened. Why is this?
Yeah, there you go. I mean, and it's definitely doable to jump in it, too, but it's a completely different experience when you have 1 and all the choices you did in 1 and everything carry over, you know, and it's going to be even more so in 3, where you have the potential that every single person you had in 2 is dead. You know, in Mass Effect 1 to 2, it was only 2 characters you could have potentially dead. Like, it's just, and this isn't game death, like, this is, they're dead, they're gone, they're out of the story.
I mean, just as a transition, since you mentioned jumping in, Daniel has joined us.
Hello.
And you came just in time, Jason. Just finished this get list. We went over this already, but since you're here, you can technically defend it now. But actually, let's get Adrian here, since he's been quiet playing his Marvel vs. Capcom in the background.
All right. So my list. My list, six games. I think that I'm going to have to start with Gears of War. For this generation, I think Gears of War did so many things right. And although I think that it was one of the games that really, really was always lagging behind in terms of, like, feature sets, multiplayer suites, things like that, I think that Gears 1 and Gears 2 both were, like, happy accidents online. I didn't really like Gears 2 that much. But I think, honestly, that a lot of the success of Gears 1 was a result of the fact that, you know, players made it into something that Epic didn't even anticipate. And then it became this huge phenomenon. And it's amazing that they were thinking at one point, they're like, we don't need multiplayer, and we're going to make it a single-player only game. And it's amazing that the game survived despite this super-duper hardcore kind of following that it had in the beginning. I don't know if any of you guys played Gears 1 online, but it was a laggy, convoluted mess. And yet,
it was not good.
It was not that great,
but
I'll be honest.
It was so good.
It was fun.
It was fun,
like,
but it was so
terrible
bad.
And awesome at the same time.
When games like Call of Duty 4 and Halo 3 were out at the time, it felt old. It felt
behind.
Well,
they weren't out at the time.
Yeah,
between those. So, I mean, it was the big multiplayer game, because honestly, nobody's going to play Perfect Dark Zero.
Yeah, well, I liked Perfect Dark Zero. I was one of the 13 people that did.
I was gonna
say, I liked it when it came out, but it was very quickly
shouted. Yeah,
I was gonna say, but what do you mean by lagging behind? Because Gears of War, I've always thought, was kind of at the forefront of it. I mean, it was the game that introduced Horde Mode, which is a staple online co-op, stuff like that.
Graphically, I think it was, but as far as Horde goes, if I'm not mistaken, I think ODST did it first.
No,
Gears 2 did it first.
Gears 2 did it first? Okay.
Gears 2 did it first.
I think Gears 2 did it first.
Yeah. Gears 2 was 2009.
Yeah, I guess I was mega wrong. The thing is those kind of games, you know, like Horde became this really great, it became a huge thing, and that's great, but I don't really dig co-op experiences that much like that. I think that they're a nice addition, and it definitely doesn't take away from the game, but I don't I'm all about competitive multiplayer and games like that. I think that that's where, for me, that's where a lot of the bulk of the content is. But, I mean, I think Gears of War was one of those games that came out and everybody was like, oh, wow, you know, this is how you do a really intense third-person shooter that's mature. And I don't know why it gets such a bad rep. It gets such a bad rep for having... for being poor storytelling.
People,
you know, I
people
mean,
see it for just like a shooter for meatheads when it's more
yeah,
than that.
I honestly think that Gears of War has much better storytelling than half the shooters out there. Definitely more so than Call of Duty. God, it blows my mind that no one ever goes, oh, you know, storytelling on Call of Duty isn't up to snuff. It's like, I don't understand why reviewers don't, you know, make that distinction. It blows my mind.
I think people do make the distinction. I just think, and I think... Gears of War 3 even got away with this, is that at times it's just the multiplayer kind of overshadows it. Like with Gears 3, a lot of people focus on beast mode and improvements to Horde. Storytelling Gears is never a thing. I mean, I don't
want to... It's more so in 3.
I think in Gears 3, I mean, have you guys played? I don't want to ruin it for Chad.
I haven't finished it, so don't spoil.
There are moments of really poignant, like... emotional things, and I won't ruin it for you because I had a friend ruin one of the key plot points in the game and I was furious, but the Gears touches on things that a lot of other games don't touch on. Like, it actually explores these really dark things, and I mean, like, you could say, like, a lot of people point to Halo when they... Alright, so bought PS3 for Uncharted and I really dug it. I mean, it was a lot of fun, and I think that one of the things that people really give shit to Uncharted 4 is the fact that it is so linear. Honestly, I think...
I was going to say that you sound like somebody else on this podcast who bought a PS3 for Uncharted and sold it right away.
I don't know. It's one of those things where I just had to play it. I really wanted to play Uncharted. It looked amazing. It was... I mean, I watched the trailer and I just would be like, I have to play this game. That was the deciding factor, is when they released that trailer and I knew that I had to play it. Other than that, though, Uncharted 2 is one of those games that I think really showed people that video games can emulate film and do it better in a number of ways. I think that the way that Uncharted developed the characters and the relationship between, you know, Elena and Drake and even Sully, I mean, although he didn't really play that huge of a role in Uncharted 2, the way that the story develops is... it's really natural up until, you know, like, the final three chapters or whatever. And it does so many things right. I mean, the shooting was solid, the cover system was fluid, and the whole, everything about the game, all the animations, the gunplay, it all felt just so like a high production movie. And although I don't think that games need to necessarily adhere to the whole, like, okay, we need to try and do everything that movies do to be considered a legitimate, you know, artistic form, but I think that if there's going to be some overlay and some overlap between the two entertainment mediums, I think that that is the way to do it, without a doubt in my mind. It's just, you can't do that any better than Uncharted 2 did. And then when you take a game like Mass Effect 2, which is also fairly linear, I think that that game is more, it's more gamey, despite the fact that it's pretty cinematic in its presentation. But it definitely has more of this video game, like, aesthetic and feel, and a lot of that comes from the fact that I think the layout, the menu system, and just the natural progression of how things work in that game, the RPG elements, everything's a little bit stiffer and more, you know, scripted, but it's hard to deny the fact that Mass Effect 2 wove this tale of intrigue over the course of, you know, however many hours I ended up playing it. And at the end, it makes you make these really interesting decisions that I think aren't really represented in Uncharted 2. Because the game Uncharted 2 doesn't make you make those decisions. And although the decisions, I'm sure Jason will, you know, appreciate this even though he's gone, I think that The Witcher 2 actually kind of goes more into that gray area as opposed to Mass Effect 2, which is all about black and white choices. Like, do you kill all the orphans or do you save them, kind of thing. And although I think Mass Effect 2 stumbled on that point, the space opera kind of idea was really well done. The love interest, the romantics, all that was really well done. And it gives you a sense of agency that a lot of games don't really touch on. And I think that that's really cool that it blends that scripted action sequences with the ability to actually kind of feel like you have some control over your character and the development of the story. And like Jason said, even the fact that, you know, the storyline itself actually has tangible results that you can see in the world as a result of your actions. Everything you do has consequences, although the decisions that you make are pretty, you know, dichotomous. I think that a lot of it is very well represented in the world as a result. Going on from that, I know that that's pretty much what everybody is going to say about Mass Effect 2 from now on. BioShock, we already talked about that. BioShock is definitely one of the best games of this generation, hands down. We already spoke about that at length, so I don't really think I need to reiterate any of that. Call of Duty 4, again, redefine the first-person shooter genre. No question. No question about that. Look at every game on the planet right now. The shittiest games on the planet are trying to like just basically do everything that Call of Duty, or well, yeah, that Call of Duty 4
it's
did.
It's not even just the shittiest games on the planet, even other games that have their own, could sell millions even if they didn't try and do what Call of Duty did.
Oh, yeah.
They're still doing what Call of Duty did.
I agree. But they do it because they know that it's a formula that's been proven to work, and it's been proven to be successful, and it's been proven to retain an audience over a large period of time. And honestly, I think it's kind of a requirement now. I mean, like when stuff like that happens, when a game comes around like Call of Duty 4 that completely renovates the entirety of what we've come to expect from progression in an online multiplayer game, you have to follow suit. I mean, it's not exactly a difficult thing to implement. It's like, okay, like you unlock the X gun at Y rank, you know, for Z points.
I don't think you need to replicate it per se. I think this is why you don't see a lot of games that do try to replicate it go far, because what is the purpose of a Call of Duty? And I know comparing it to Halo is kind of a mute point because that was a big franchise beforehand. But Halo kind of integrated the ideas without copying it. You get the credits and stuff, but it doesn't unlock perks and weapons. It goes more towards just like customization of your character. So I prefer Halo's method because it doesn't unbalance the game in any fashion. There's no like, okay, I've been playing this game for 100 hours, so I'm better equipped than you are when you first start this game because you don't have all these perks unlocked.
See, while I do agree with that, I think that, you know, a lot of games like you mentioned have. I mean, even Gears of War 3. You know, there's not really much that you get from Gears of War 3 as a result of your progression. You unlock more characters. You unlock things that you can show off to other people that basically say, wow, I've played this game a lot. And there's the one thing that I would like to see games do differently than Call of Duty 4, and that's stop rewarding the player for everything. I think that
Gears of War is actually a very big criminal of this. I don't know if you noticed, but you get points for being the first to die in a round. You get points for picking up the least ammo in the round. You get points for doing this, doing that. Call of Duty 4 was all about rewarding people for doing good, whereas Gears of War, on the reverse, it rewards people for doing good, but it also rewards people for it's not necessarily ass. Doing good at all.
But that's the natural progression of the Call of Duty system, is that at some point you're just, like, people are not going to play a game if they don't get rewarded for something, and you're not going to do it if you don't get rewarded. But yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I think Uncharted has something like that too, where you get rewarded if you die 3 times in a row without getting a kill, or if you stay in cover for a certain number of time, or if you just run around the map for all you get XP or money for that as well. And yeah, it has to come, there has to be some type of balance where, like, you're rewarding skill, but you're not, because if you don't reward everything, then nobody's going to play because you don't get enough feedback. But if you reward everything, it's just like nothing I do is special.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that there needs to be a really solid balance, but I think a lot of people are kind of ignoring the fact that gamers, you know, we've really become this imprivileged, we've really become this privileged and entitled generation of gamers, and we expect to be rewarded for everything. And I think that that's something that is just unacceptable. I don't like that. I like the fact that in Halo, like Halo, you know, as much as I didn't really like Halo 3, and as much as I don't, you know, I can't really say that I loved Reach either. But I do think that the one of the things that Halo does really, really well is it has this thing like, okay, you play games, you get credits, you know, you get these things that you can use to buy, you know, accessories and armor that are just basically permutations that are completely for aesthetic purposes and serve no other, have absolutely no other purpose. So I think that's a really solid way to do things. But also they have the rank system and the levels where you will have a visible rank that shows how good you are, and it basically is this one is at is an at a glance representation of your skills of the game, and it will go down and it will go up, and it is there's nothing more frustrating than playing a game like that, and you know, like seeing a number that you probably invest a little bit of stock into because you're, you know, if you play the game fairly regularly, then I'm guessing you're going to be like, oh, I want to be considered good. So having that always on the line, you know, kind of makes each and every game have a little bit more gravity, like intensity. You want to win. You don't play the game because you're like, oh, I'm just going to fuck around and get hell assists or whatever. You don't do that.
I do.
I don't play the games to do that. Like it's when I play a competitive multiplayer game, I want there to be some give and take. And I get that, huh?
The competitive nature is actually what turned me off from Call of Duty 4.
But that's the thing is, how many other people were super into it? You know, I know that you don't really seem to, you don't really prefer a lot of, we have very different tastes in video games. But I do think that the vast majority of people, sorry, were pretty enamored with the fact that a game like that came around and just reinvented everything. And then... I think that needs to happen again because I think it's getting a little bit stale and it's getting a little bit played out. But
I can say, do people gravitate towards it because of the XP and the competitive nature, or because it was such a big game you could play with your friends and have fun with it, and you always feel like you're making that forward progression? I don't necessarily think it's because, oh, you know what, I went 21-2 in this game. It's kind of like, oh, I'm playing with friends, and we did well as a group. I think because even Halo, I don't think Halo, you have team games, but I think in Call of Duty you function more as a team. Even though you're kind of like you can become like a one-man Superman in that game, but you still kind of have like that team strategy. You start at the same point for the most part. You all kind of branch out. You kind of work together to set up perks and, you know, traps and stuff like that. Where like something like Halo, it's kind of like, you know, like I'll watch your back, but there's not much else I can do for you other than shoot the other guy.
Right. But that's what I mean. Like, I think a really good example of a game that does rewards, you know, teamwork is another great games. Perfect segue. Bad Company 2 does an outstanding job of really encouraging team play in an era where people are very selfish and very individualistic in their play styles. And I think that games like Call of Duty have only perpetuated this idea that when you get on to an online game, it's all about you. It's all about getting that, you know, 15 kill streak, or 11 kill streak, getting AC-130, and just doing work. You know, and I think that that's great, and I think that people really dig that, and it's cool for a game where, you know, maybe you don't have a lot of friends online, and you just want to go on and dominate some people. But at the same time, I think it really encourages the wrong play styles. And I mean, it's hard to say to somebody, hey, you know, like, you're playing this game wrong if they're having fun with it. You can't really do that. That's kind of, you know, it would be impertinent of me to say that you're playing a game wrong when, as long as you're having fun with it, it doesn't really matter how you play it. One of the things, though, that I think Bad Company 2 does is it encourages team play, and as a result, the way that the point system works is that it's designed to make you play the game the way it's meant to be played. And the way that it's meant to be played ends up being the best way to play the game, in my opinion. And that's teamwork and providing, you know. So what do you do? Like, oh, you run around, you throw ammo down. Oh, you get points for ammo. You go, okay, I'm just going to do this a bunch. And it streamlines that whole process so you're not having to really think about it. You see people, you throw ammo, you throw health. And the way that the game rewards you for those things makes it automatic and conditions you to do that. And as a result, the whole game, despite having, you know, 12v12, compared to Call of Duty, which I'm pretty sure does 6v6, it's amazing that the game manages to take that many players and create some level of synergy between the three different squads on each team.
The thing with Bad Company 2 is it's a more hostile environment when you play it online because there's tanks going around that can kill you from the other side of the map if somebody is sitting in it who really knows how to use it. And there are snipers that can kill you from the other side of the map that you can't see if they really know how to use the sniper rifle. So you need to be doing the right things at the right times and helping your team out in order to be successful. Otherwise, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really...
bleeding tickets.
I agree. I think that's really frustrating for a lot of people that have become used to the Call of Duty style of gameplay because they're so used to be able to be this, you know, force of nature that needs to be reckoned with, and they can just run through bullets and stab people with commando perks or whatever. And I know that's not Modern Warfare 3 anymore, but the point still stands that Call of Duty is all about the individual. It's all about the single person being able to do as much damage as possible. And Bad Company 2 does that so differently and distinguishes itself, and it basically separates itself so much from Call of Duty in that regard that it creates an entirely different experience, even though both games are first-person shooters and they both have a lot of comparisons. I mean, there's, you know, some gun overlay, but each gun, I mean, in addition to that, let me just talk about the gunplay in Backcountry 2 for a second, which is, holy shit, incredible. And I did some reading about this, and it blows my mind that every single game on the planet that has guns in it isn't doing this. So
I said the same thing about Active Reload, but...
Yeah, I agree. Active Reload is incredible. What was I going to say? Okay, so in Backcountry 2, I don't know if you guys know this, but each gun, each weapon is basically considered an entity in the real world. It's not just, you know, hit scan, where it just, like, puts a bunch of, you know, shoots out a bunch of things into the atmosphere, and if they touch something, you know, it has infinite speed. The bullet has infinite speed, has infinite range. It has little to no bullet drop, much like Call of Duty. So bullets will hit instantly in a game like Call of Duty because of hit scan. In Bad Company 2, what ends up happening is each gun, each bullet that's fired, is rendered in a physical infrastructure that basically calculates each bullet's trajectory, and there's an algorithm that is designed to basically, you know, it's probably a very simple algorithm. It's very effective because obviously the game would lag intensely if the, you know, CPU couldn't handle these complicated geometric, you know, things where, you know, the Coriolis effect needs to be taken into place and all that stuff. But it's really neat because, I mean, every gun is affected by this, and it makes the guns have this weight and this really, really, I can't think of any other word besides tangible feel. Like, you can actually feel like you're holding the weapon in your hands. And Battlefield 3 takes this to another extent. And I don't know if it uses the same system, but I do know that it feels really, really good to have that gun in your hand.
The best way of experiencing it, I found, is having a bullet whiz by your face. Because you literally dodged a bullet, and that could have killed you if you weren't careful.
The game is, and the sound design. The HDR audio is the best thing to happen to that to shooters. I mean, you play a game like Backcountry 2, and it's just like these echoes and these rumbles, and you can hear things in the distance that are actually existing. It's not just ambient noise that has been placed there by the developers to make you feel like you're in a war zone. It's stuff that's actually happening on the battlefield. People are actually doing it. And it creates this atmosphere and this ambiance that really, really sucks you in. It makes you feel, like, stressed. And I don't think Call of Duty does a really good job of that. I think Call of Duty actually does a terrible job of that because each gun sounds like a fucking airsoft gun, and they all sound ridiculously just underpowered and just... Whereas in Battlefield, these guns have these just hefty weight.
They boom when you shoot.
Yeah, they boom. Exactly, they boom. And it's insane that each game, each shooter doesn't really... It's the little things that DICE put into that game that make it so good, and that's why it's so frustrating to me when, you know, we talked about Battlefield 3, but when DICE, you know, dropped the ball on the whole thing, because I think it's clearly a better game. It's more refined, it's better tuned, whatever. That's another story for another day. Moving on, Oblivion. Holy God, Oblivion. I must have played this game. I'm not ashamed to admit it. There was one time in my life where me and my buddy just played the game for 9 hours straight. We stripped him down to his little loincloth, and we're just like, let's go find ourselves in the woods. And we just kind of, like, ventured out and, you know, leveled up our acrobatics for hours. And it's amazing that that game managed to... The reason that I liked that game so much and why I hated Fallout so much was the game was actually... It had this sense of spectacle. The soundtrack was incredible. The way that the game allowed you to just have this free roam and everything was interesting... And combat was satisfying, even though, like, you know, in retrospect, if we look at it now, it probably looks pretty archaic. But it was just so good. It was so unbelievably good. It was so addicting, so immersive. And Skyrim just builds on all those things. Oblivion literally sucked hundreds of hours of my life. It was such a good game. And although I really built my character in the worst possible way, I mean, he was like a wood elf with glass armor, and he was basically a big piece of shit. Because I didn't know how good magic was in that game until I started playing it for 50 hours, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, anyway. But speaking on that, there's really not much else you can say about Oblivion other than it was a great game that really did the open-ended world idea just perfectly. Everything was just, it was so gratifying to explore. And it's the only game where I go, you know, there's the beaten path. I'm going to go the exact opposite way. And I'm going to hope, I mean, and then the game will always reward that. It'll be like, oh, you decided to not follow this little direction, and here's like a little side quest that you might not have gotten had you not, you know, gone this way. So I think the game really explores or rewards exploration, and a lot of games don't do that these days, and it's really, really satisfying to see that. My final game, and I think this really, really bears an honorable mention because it basically redefined what we expect from movie games. That's Arkham Asylum. I know that Earl will actually agree with me on this one, amazingly.
Oh, I'm going to disagree with you on it being a movie game.
Oh, I mean, comic book game, superhero game.
Licensed,
thank you. Arkham Asylum blew my mind. It was one of those games that really, really, I mean, as someone who was always kind of a passive fan of Batman, I'd always thought he was a really cool character, but games like this and Ultimate Marvel, they've made me kind of, like, realize that in another life, I probably would have been a comic book nerd.
I can't just be a comic book fan.
Yeah, it just made me a comic book fan. It made me really kind of explore these worlds, and it made me take the whole comic book world much more seriously. You know, I would go on Wikipedia, and I would read all these things like, oh, I didn't even know Dick Grayson was Batman at one point. I don't even know who Dick Grayson was before. Who's Tim Drake? And it's all this stuff that I had just, you know, blissfully ignorant of because I just was like, oh, comic books, whatever. But that game made Batman so cool and captured the same essence that The Dark Knight had about Batman. It had that same level of, it was so dark and grungy. And there were some areas where I felt like they could have gone a little bit further and they really could have pushed that teen rating. But Batman is one of those franchises that is inherently just very tragic. It's a very tragic kind of world, and it's dark and it's gothic, and it's so misrepresented in so many games. And I mean, to see Arkham Asylum really nail that home and make you feel like, not only feel like Batman, but capture all that makes Batman so cool, that was an amazing accomplishment by Rocksteady Studios. And considering the fact that the developer I had never even heard of.
Do you know why they never heard of them? Because they'd only made one game before that was only released in the EU.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They made several games before that, weren't
they? No, Arkham Asylum was the second game. It was the first one that they made to be released outside of Europe and North America.
Wow.
So there you go.
Interesting.
And I think that's such an accomplishment for what was effectively a really small studio.
Yeah, it was amazing. But the fact that they, you know, they did it right. They worked with Paul Dini. They got the story written out. And it was everything that I wanted. You know, and it's funny because I remember, like, to this day, I remember I was looking in a Game Informer one day and I saw, you know, Batman Arkham Asylum. Yeah, it was just the fact that they did it so right. Paul Dini coming on board, doing the storyline. Great move. It was such a good game. The combat was so smooth and it was so satisfying. Countering people, combat takedowns, the Riddler challenges. Everything was just on point to such an extent that it was very, very impressive that, like you said, Daniel, it was just amazing that such a small studio came out of nowhere and basically rocked.
Blew everyone away.
Huh?
Blew everyone away was something that nobody expected to ever happen.
And it's what a good Batman game? Jesus Christ, what the hell is this? Like,
it's a good Batman game, and the fact that you didn't expect anything from this studio. I mean, I honestly remembered shrugging it off when I first, I'm like, oh, it's a Batman game. I love Batman, as anybody who knows me knows. And I shrugged it off. I'm like, I'm not going to buy this. It's going to be crap. And then the demo came out on Xbox Live, and I think this is why demos are so important, though. They seem to be having diminishing returns at the end of this generation. The demo came out, and it's just like, it's like three rooms, but I played that thing like 10 times.
It was just such a good game. I mean, it wasn't even a good Batman game. It wasn't even just a good Batman game.
It was a phenomenal Batman game.
All right. No, I mean,
Batman's pretty good.
Batman was damn good.
Yes, it was.
/ I hated it.
Just to recap, because Adrian keeps on getting disconnected. Uncharted 2, Gears of War, Mass Effect 2, Call of Duty 4, Oblivion, Arkham Asylum, Battlefield Bad Company 2.
Yep.
Our lists are actually really similar.
Godlike.
There's a lot of crossover. I think I have the most radically different list here, and even then there's still a lot of crossover.